This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Good afternoon. I'm Chris Nolte. It's Thursday, which means it's Reporters Roundtable Day. We'll talk with a number of reporters from local media to find out about the stories that they've posted online and had put in print as well. Today, we'll talk with, from the Times, State House reporter Dan Carton. He has a number of stories as the General Assembly session continues, just about to the midway point. We'll find out about that and other things, too, from Dan. Also, we'll talk to Carrie Napoleon from the Post-Tribune. She has some stories on local politics as well. Joseph Pete, the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana, will join us with a number of local and area stories involving business. And Greg Tejeda, who covers news from Gary for the Post-Tribune, will join us as well. Let's go first to the State House, at least news of not only what's happening in the General Assembly, but related news as well, too. And for that, we're turning to Times of Northwest Indiana State House reporter Dan Carton. Hi, Dan. Thanks for being with us today.
Hi. How are you? Great to be here.
I'm fine, and thanks for taking a break from keeping an eye on the General Assembly to bring us up to date on some of the things that you've had in print and online here. Let's start first here, if we may, with the news about Healthy Indiana Plan and the fact that the feds have gone ahead and extended for another period.
Yeah, they extended it for one more month, and this is the existing plan.
Mm-hmm.
If you remember, almost a year ago now, Governor Holcomb requested that the feds allow Indiana to impose a work requirement on some Healthy Indiana Plan recipients. Governor believes that will help them get off what is effectively a Medicaid program and onto presumably an employer health insurance program when they get a job. The Trump administration signaled that they were really open to that, and they were going to move quickly and get it done, and they've just kind of really dragged their feet on it. So now it's a year later, and they still haven't decided. So the state went ahead and requested that the existing program continue for another month while the feds try to figure out if they're going to let Indiana's HIP renewal go through with the work requirement. There's little question that they will. It's just a matter of when they get around to it.
I know that there had been some concern, I guess, in Indianapolis whether Seema Verna, who is the architect of HIP, basically, and then went on, of course, to the Trump administration, decided to go ahead and push for this approval or not. So it looks like that at least for now, unless it's in, you know, for they're waiting to find out more because you say they're looking for that work requirement approval before they can go further.
Right. Yeah, that's what was so sort of weird about how long it's taking for the Trump administration to approve this. The people who are making the decisions about approving it are the ones who came up with the plan when they were working in Indiana under Governor Pence. So it's just kind of a strange thing, you know, when Governor Pence said to the Obama administration that we wanted to take the Obamacare money and use it to expand health care in the state. It only took a few months for them to approve it.
Mm-hmm.
Even with Indiana's sort of unique Medicaid program where participants are required to pay a portion of their income, even if they have very little income. And for the Trump administration, which basically came up with this work requirement part of HIP, to be dragging its feet on approving it is kind of strange to the Holcomb administration, which has been extremely loyal to pretty much everything the Trump people want them to do.
Yeah. One other story that you've had out here is from community health care and dealing with the opioid crisis here, of course, in Northwest Indiana and across the state. And they've decided that they're going to take a little different approach to fighting the problem, the opioid epidemic in Indiana, and linking up, I guess, with a database that comes out of Indianapolis. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. Governor Holcomb last year urged hospitals to connect to what's called the INSPECT database, and this is a state database where anytime somebody in Indiana has a prescription filled for a controlled substance, which would include opioid drugs because they're so powerful, it gets recorded in this database, and the people who use the database can check to see if whether somebody has recently been prescribed opioids or recently has had a lot of similar prescriptions in the past, which might suggest that they've been addicted. It's just been taking some time for hospitals and other providers to connect to this system because in the past it was kind of a closed system just within pharmacies. And now one of Governor Holcomb's ideas was to, you know, get the provider community into this. So if somebody's shopping around for doctors to give them prescriptions for these powerful drugs, you know, a doctor can check this system and say, well, you know, you've already got this many pills, you probably don't need any more.
Now, how many hospitals will be able to take advantage of this being part of the INSPECT system then?
Well, this is, so this announcement was the community hospital, the community healthcare system. So you've got community hospital in Munster, St. Catharines in East Chicago, and St. Mary Medical Center in Hobart. And then other hospitals are coming online throughout the state. This one was just, you know, I wrote about this one because it was relevant to Northwest Indiana.
Right, I see. We're talking with Dan Carton, who's a State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And let's jump into some of the news from the State House. And one of the stories you had on online as well as in print this week dealt with getting close to the halfway point for the General Assembly in 2018. And there were some deadlines that everybody was watching very closely if they'd meet. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. You know, the General Assembly just convened in January, barely a month ago, and now we're at the halfway point. In fact, the House of Representatives today is today's the last day to change a bill before it has to be voted on by Monday if it's going to advance to the Senate. Bills that originated in the Senate have until Tuesday to pass the Senate to get to the House. Otherwise, they're dead for the year, basically. So, you know, of the 800 legislative proposals that were filed just a month ago, probably three-quarters of them will be dead next week.
Wow, wow.
Yeah.
I know one bill in particular we've been kind of waiting to find out how it would turn out. It was one that unfortunately has gotten kicked out of the hopper, so to speak, here, and that's the one that State Representative Charlie Brown from Gary had put out there, House Bill 1380, talking about dealing with smoking and the problems of cigarettes in Indiana. Tell us how that's happened to turn out the way it did and what's going to happen now.
Yeah, so he, Charlie Brown has been an anti-smoking advocate for his entire career at the State House. This is going to be his last session. He's planning to run for a Lake County office in November.
Mm-hmm.
And he persuaded this House committee to approve his plan that would increase the smoking age to 21 in Indiana. There's a few states that prohibit smoking by anyone under 21, and he wanted Indiana to be among those states purely from a health perspective. He believes smoking is, well, he knows smoking is dangerous, and especially dangerous for younger people, and if you can stop people from smoking before they are 21, they are extremely unlikely to pick up the habit as they grow up, or as they, you know, as an adult. So his measure was approved unanimously by this committee, but there's some controversy about this, but the idea is that, the thinking is, that increasing the smoking age would reduce state cigarette tax revenue, because people from 18 to 21 would not be smoking and therefore not buying cigarettes, and the state would not be getting taxes off of that. So that the revenue loss required the Speaker of the House to send the bill to another committee that looks specifically at state revenue. That committee did not act on the bill before the deadline, and so his legislation is pretty much dead for the year. So that's not likely to advance anymore.
Now, how do things stand as it is today, at least, on the issue of Sunday retail alcohol sales?
Yeah, I mean, that one is going considerably better. So the House and the Senate have each passed legislation separately allowing Sunday sales between noon and 8 p.m. You can already drink at a bar or a restaurant on Sundays. This would be to buy at a store, you know, to take home and drink there. So those measures have both passed the House and Senate. They just need to switch or trade them. So normally at the halfway point of the session, which will be next week, they trade the bills. You know, the Senate will send the House the bills that it has approved. The House will send the bills to the Senate. So whichever one wants to get around to passing it first, that's the one that'll go to the governor. And Governor Holcomb told me last week that he'll sign the Sunday sales.
No,
as soon as it gets on his desk.
That's what they've been pushing for. You know, if they can only deal with the beer situation, I guess that'll happen. Maybe that'll come maybe next session, eh?
The cold beer?
The cold beer situation,
yeah.
Yes. Right.
Yeah, well, yeah, that's a whole different can of worms. the liquor stores are pretty fiercely defending their cold beer monopoly. So, you know, they're willing to give on Sunday sales at this point, but cold beer is probably going to be a bigger fight in the years to come.
One of the other measures I know that came up here for discussion before the General Assembly gets close to home here, it's dealing with the Gary Community School Corporation's Board of Directors and how lawmakers have decided to be able to find a way to diminish the school board's powers even more. Tell us about that.
Yeah, they're at the House. I actually just stepped out of the House just a minute ago to take your call. The House is actually debating this as we speak. It's legislation. So the Gary School Board was effectively, sidelined last year by an emergency manager after the district had racked up, consistently unbalanced budgets, racked up $100 million in debt. The state said, no more school trustees. You guys aren't running the district in any kind of reasonable way. So they put in the emergency manager. This measure kind of clarifies that the emergency manager really is in charge and officially makes the board an advisory body to her rather than the official governing body of the school district.
Now, how have been some of the reaction from members of the Northwest Indiana legislative delegation about that?
As you might imagine, not very happy,
I would imagine.
Yeah, so. Legislators representing Gary aren't especially happy about it. It's interesting their sort of vehemence on this measure, which really doesn't do much. It just sort of makes what's obvious to everybody in law, whereas last year they were much more on board with the state taking over the district because they thought it would, well, and it has, they thought it would help out their community. At this point they're saying by diminishing the role of the school board, they're saying you're usurping the will of the voters because these school trustees are elected and the state is in effect, getting rid of an elected body. But the supporters of the measure say that the school board really doesn't have any power and the law should reflect that.
And finally, Dan Carton, there's one other measure that come up before the legislature that you've had a chance to report on down there at the State House, and it's dealing with the CBD oil. Will you explain that and tell us what the Indiana House has decided to go forth on?
Yeah, if you remember back in November, the Attorney General of Indiana, Republican Curtis Hill, said that even though Indiana lawmakers last year agreed that people with treatment-resistant epilepsy should be allowed to buy CBD oil, which is derived from marijuana but doesn't have the ingredients in marijuana that produces a high, Curtis Hill said CBD oil is still illegal because under federal law, you're not allowed to have any marijuana-related products of any kind. That did not sit well with Governor Holcomb, and that did not sit well with Hammond Mayor Tom McDermott.
Especially his dog.
they've repeatedly confronted the Attorney General about that on social media.
Right.
And members of the House and Senate aren't really on board with Curtis Hill's interpretation of the law, so they're changing the law. So instead of just people with epilepsy eligible to buy CBD oil, they're saying, they're approving measures that would allow any Hoosier to buy CBD oil. You don't have to register with the state. You don't have to do anything. I mean, there are some conditions on what the product can include.
Yeah.
It has to be a low level of that drug that produces a high.
Yeah, the THC, yes.
Right. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it looks like this is, going to pass.
I recall in some of the conversation, I know before the vote, that there was a state legislator had a very very interesting testimonial that he actually uses the oil for his personal use. It's aside from the Hammond mayor's family members, so to speak. It's something that actually comes to mind here, the fact that there are people of all walks of life that are members of the Indiana General Assembly, and they're liable to have all kinds of different physical and other problems as well, too, that they can rely on.
Yeah, and there's a real growing libertarian streak in the General Assembly. Sort of tell everybody how you should live republicanism. It's really giving away to sort of a live and let live on some matters. And this marijuana is one of them. I mean, we're not at the point where, the Indiana lawmakers are going to legalize marijuana, but they did approve a plan to study medicinal marijuana. So that's probably going to be a study committee this summer for possible legislative action in 2019. So this idea, this marijuana regulation, you know, it's really changed as the members of the General Assembly get younger and just sort of other states have experimented with this and really haven't had many problems with it.
Well, Dan, well, let's get back to checking in on the conversation about the Gary Community School Board and that measure that's going through right now and then see what comes out of that. And we do appreciate you taking time from what's happening at the State House to talk with us today. We've been talking with Dan Carton, who's the State House reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And thank you once again for joining us on the show today.
Thank you.
And you're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Continuing on with Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio, let's turn now to Carrie Napoleon from the Post Tribune. And Carrie's taking a break from covering the Sumava Resorts murder trial to join us on the program today. Thanks, Carrie.
Oh, thanks for having me. Well, Good afternoon.
Well, you've had, besides the murder trial that you've gotten assigned by your editors to cover, and of course you can check online as well as in the Post Tribune when it comes out tomorrow, the latest on the trial. But one of the things that you have, it takes care of some politics here in Northwest Indiana and in Lake County in particular, about how the Democrats are about to really, really make the Lake County Commissioner's primary election race a very interesting one to watch.
Yes, it is definitely going to be an interesting one to watch with Jamal Washington challenging current Commissioner Kyle Allen for his seat. Now, this will be the first time Kyle has run. He was appointed to that seat by caucus, so this is his first technical election as well for that seat. But, yeah, that should be a very interesting race.
When we come down to what Mr. Washington has wanted to do, he had talked about, I guess, at one point, not running for county commissioner. What was his rationale for deciding not to run for county clerk, but instead decide to run for county commissioner?
You know, when I spoke with him, he did not elaborate in great detail. He said he had just thought on it and prayed on it and decided that this was the seat that he wanted to pursue to finish what he had accomplished so far on the county council, since the two positions are somewhat related in how they interact.
And we know for sure that the council, of course, tends to deal with money matters, budgets, and the like. But the county commissioners get to actually run the county, and they're responsible for making sure that the things happen when they're supposed to happen in the county government offices. So I'm sure he probably feels that that's probably a bit more powerful position even than what he is able to do so far on the county council.
Exactly, and that was a similar with what happened with Mike Repay when he moved from the council and ran for the commissioners.
Mm-hmm.
You do have a little more control over actual policy and contracts and direction as a commissioner. And Washington is particularly interested in the Human Resources Department, which is going to be new, and the Minority Black Enterprise legislation they enacted last year that kind of gives a preference to local minority-owned businesses doing business with the county.
Now, what does Mr. Allen have to say about seeing another candidate that he'll have to face on the primary ticket?
Bring it on.
That's a simple way to put it, isn't it?
He said he's ready to face any and all comers, and it doesn't really matter, you know, who they are. He stands on the work that he's accomplished since he's been there and, you know, just plans to continue working for his constituents and moving forward and would like to do that.
Now, we know that State Representative Charlie Brown is still busy dealing with his matters in Indianapolis, but soon, once the General Assembly wraps up the session, and that's his last session to attend in Indianapolis, he'll be coming back up here to continue working to stay in public office. And this time, he wants to take on a local office here. There are a number of things I'm sure he has in mind that he'd like to do.
Yes, he's looking to take the district three county council seat, which is currently held by Jamal Washington. And that currently has four candidates running for the Democratic nomination. Charlie Brown, Runya Scott, Leonard White, and Melissa Borum. So that should be kind of an interesting race, too, to see who fills in.
And you mentioned about Ronier Scott. I guess he's decided to get back into politics. He's had to spend some time out, I understand, and I'm sure he's probably had something to say about how he feels that the way that Lake County government's been run.
You know, I haven't actually spoken to him yet. Mm-hmm. We haven't done any election preview stories, so I've only seen, you know, what he has posted and talked about publicly. But I'm sure that he is very interested in coming back. Charlie's going to be a very difficult candidate to beat.
Mm-hmm. I would imagine so. And one of the other council members, I know, member two, is going to seek a re-election, but Elsie Franklin has a challenge that's coming up ahead in the primary election, doesn't she?
Yes, yeah, she sure does. She actually has three challengers so far as well. She has... Oops, hang on one second. It slid out of my slid off my screen there. But she does have three challengers,
uh-huh.
And they're familiar names. There are people that came before and have challenged her in the past. One of them is a new fellow. His first name is Jeremy. This is his first race that he's running for, so it's a big step to go after. Kind of one of the political big dogs. Elsie has been around for a long time. His name is Jeremy Yancey, but then Gloria Slay and Dorothy Spires are the other two who are challenging, and they've challenged her in the past. So we'll have to kind of see how this moves forward as well.
Okay. Now, what's the deadline for filing to be able to run for a public office in the primary election?
Noon, February 9th.
It's coming up.
Friday.
Yes. So I'm sure we'll see another forest of candidates stop by the election board office and put in their paperwork to be able to get on the ballot in time to make it, that to be sure. One other story I know.
Most definitely.
One other story I know for sure that the Carrie that you had dealt with Lake County corrections officers and pay raises. Tell us about that.
Now, they are currently, the corrections officers in the county are currently in contract negotiations.
Mm-hmm.
So what they've recently done was extend the current existing contract for 6 months. And as part of that contract calls for the correction officers to be treated as other employees. Last year, all the other employees got a 3% increase for this year. So that increase, when they extended the contract, was passed along to the correctional officers. If they would not have extended the contract, that wouldn't have happened. And there was a little discussion. Councilwoman Christine Sid from East Chicago did not agree with that move. She kind of thought it was giving up the chip by paying the raise now while negotiations are still going underway.
Now, obviously, we don't know what's going on as far as the negotiations are concerned, but I would imagine that the correctional officers would probably like things to go well enough so that if they get that 3% raise now that they're supposed to get from county government, that they actually get to keep that it doesn't go down.
And that is what they've budgeted for. The county has budgeted for 3%. The bargaining team has, tentatively agreed to 3%. Some of the issues that are still holding up have more to do with staffing and some other type of issues as opposed to pay. So I think there is an agreement that when we move forward with this contract, 3% is kind of where we want to be.
Okay. And finally, Carrie, one story that you had in the Post Tribune here recently, also dealing with the Lake County Sheriff's Department about the officers in particular, is some new handguns that officers are going to be getting. They finally got some money set aside to replace their weaponry.
Yes, it's 293 new handguns. They're all going to be getting new ones. It's the first time in 12 years for a lot of them, if not a little longer. So their guns, they've been used quite a bit. Not that guns can technically go bad, but the technology changes. They get safer, they get better. So, you do need to upgrade once in a while, apparently.
Now, what has Sheriff Oscar Martinez had to say about this? Was he been looking forward to making the changeover for his officers?
Yes, he said it really is a safety issue, having guns that, for some of these guns, the repairs, because they fire them a lot, while they may not be firing them at individuals or in scenes, they practice, and these guns get used a lot, so components wear out, and they need to be replaced. And for a lot of the guns, it got to the point where they couldn't be repaired cost effectively anymore because the parts were so worn.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes a safety issue. You want to pull it out and know it's going to work, and, police should be able to pull their weapons out and know they're going to work.
At last check, do you have any idea when they're supposed to have the guns delivered from the vendor?
I do not know. Mm-hmm. I do not know. We will be following up with that, though. It'll be kind of neat, I think, to see them, especially if they come in all in mass.
Okay.
That's a lot of handguns.
That's true, yeah, with a big order like that, to be sure. Carrie Napoleon covers stories mainly about Lake County government for the Post Tribune, and this week she's been spending time on a murder trial, and then we'll find out, of course, more online as well as in print about that, too. But, Carrie, we thank you very much for taking a break from the trial to be with us today.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
You too. And you're listening to Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. On Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's turn to business now. And for that, of course, we turn to Joseph Peet, who is the business reporter and writer for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And Joseph, I know there's some new developments in the steel industry nationwide as well as here in Northwest Indiana. And some of it has to deal with profits. One story that is, I guess, breaking is the latest on U.S. Steel. And maybe if you have the update on that, we'd appreciate that. But tell us, be sure, about ArcelorMittal.
Oh, absolutely. Yes, it was a good year for both ArcelorMittal and U.S. Steel. That was largely as a result of the higher steel prices. The market conditions have kind of improved tremendously. Part of that is the anticipation of additional tariffs or quotas or crackdowns from the Section 232 investigation. But prices have kind of they have been slack for a while. The price of a flat rolled coil steel is $726 per ton last year, up from $666 per ton. Previous year, it had been as low as like 400 a couple years ago when the industry was really going through travails and the imports were at a record high. But it's been the price has been strongly rebounding. U.S. Steel just announced last night after the markets closed that it had turned a profit of $389 million. It's only its second profit in the last 8 years, second annual profit. It had lost like $440 million the previous year, $1.6 billion the year before that. It's but the improved market conditions really helped it out. They also got new leadership. They brought in the new CEO, David Burritt, after Mario Longhi. Everyone was expecting them to do really well in the first quarter because prices were rising everything, but it turned out they had deferred, you know, all the maintenance and everything, and they weren't able to capitalize off of that. So that led to the ouster of previous CEO Mario Longhi after they had some pretty disastrous results in the first quarter. Mm-hmm. They didn't do that great in the second quarter either, but they were able to turn it around for the year. And after making $159 million in the fourth quarter, it helped boost their overall annual results to like $389 million. ArcelorMittal also had a big profitable year last year. Unfortunately, they might not result in any profit sharing locally. It's believed that the U.S. I haven't been able to confirm 100% yet, but they're warning that the U.S. operations might not have been profitable. That would mean the local workers would still get a bonus because there was an agreement in the contract that if steel prices were above like $600 a ton or something, they get a bonus, like depending on how high the prices are. Yeah. So they will see some extra money because of the prices were at $726 a ton for last year, but they may not see the profit sharing because the American operations, they'll often say, are not as profitable as they are globally. They, however, made $5.4 billion last year as a global company. That's a 30% year-over-year increase. They had a pretty good year. Yeah, the conditions just generally have improved, and both U.S. Steel and ArcelorMittal are expecting to be profitable again next year. Hopefully that will play into the contract negotiations that are coming up between the United Steelworkers Union and both the steelmakers. Yeah. It was completely different 3 years ago. Both of them were hemorrhaging money at the time, losing money. The steelworkers were forced to fight to prevent like as few concessions as they could. They wanted to take away a lot of their health insurance. They ended up not getting raises, but they're able to protect some of their benefits. But, you know, retirees lost a little bit. But this year, the conditions have completely flipped. Things are going pretty good for the steel workers. But we'll see. The companies, as some steel workers have been complaining, the companies often have a way of pleading poverty, during contract talks, even if things are generally going pretty good for them.
Well, that's historic for them. I mean, even going back to Andrew Carnegie days, you know, they've complained about, we never make enough money. So they use that as one of their tools at negotiation time, to be sure, I imagine. Do you think that the latest state as far as the sanctions against the foreign steelmakers is showing some effect, and in turn, it's make things better for the domestic steelmakers like U.S. Steel and ArcelorMittal?
Well, it has helped strengthen the prices a lot. Yeah. There are currently this has been an issue for some time. Like we have trade agreements, and there are multiple rules saying like what you can and can't do as far as they're not allowed to subsidize
you know, steel production abroad. They're not allowed to, you know, sell below cost to try and gain market share. There are, like, explicit rules that spell out, like, what's allowed. That's pretty common. Pretty much every country has some kind of trade agreements with their trade partners that, like, spell out things like that, because you want everybody to compete on a fair and level playing field. While, you know, you want the benefit and competition of trade, you don't want to let other people come in and take all your manufacturing jobs. And we've had more than 180, I believe it's 189 tariffs on steel products alone from countries all over the world, from like 30 or 40 different countries. More than half of the steel producing countries that export here, they have been ongoing. We have tariffs as high as like 500% tariffs against most of the products that are made in China. But there's been this anticipation that there's going to be even more, coming up, because there's that big Section 232 investigation that was announced last year into whether steel products or these steel imports are really hurting national security, because the thinking is we need to be able to produce steel domestically if there's ever another big war, because we have to be able to produce our own ships, our own tanks, our own military vehicles. If we're forced to rely upon outside suppliers, we can't guarantee that they'll have our interests aligned with theirs, that they will, you know, that they can't be bought out by another person. We want to ensure that we still have that capacity. So there's been, the administration's been looking into a further crackdown, which could potentially include things like quotas on limiting the amount of, right now about like 27% of the steel that is consumed in the United States is made somewhere abroad in some foreign country. They could potentially like limit that to, say, for instance, 20%, something like that, as a result of this investigation. But we're not going to find out anywhere until the next 90 days. But it could go above and beyond just the regular tariffs that they slap on to kind of usually what the case will be is they'll find that, Taiwan or someone had, you know, been subsidizing, or Turkey had been subsidizing steel makers there and paying them a subsidy of X amount. And then they'll, you know, go in and increase the amount. They'll add basically a tax on the imports from that country, you know, to kind of level it out. So it's not as though they never enjoyed that benefit, because we in America certainly have not provided our steel makers with any kind of, like, you know, incentives like that. We're not providing them with heavy subsidies that you see in a lot of the other countries like China, mm-hmm. where they're basically, you know, deliberately subsidizing good paying steelworker jobs. Here they operate on the free market and are kind of left on their own to sink or swim.
We're talking with Joseph Pete, who's business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And of course, we're talking about the steel company. And coke is an integral, essential part of making steel. And one big supplier of coke for Northwest Indiana steel mills has gotten in trouble with the feds and the state government here about pollution. And that's one of the stories that you've covered recently, too. Bring us up to date on that, please.
Yes. SunCoke, they're a big supplier to ArcelorMittal Indiana Harbor. Their permit had been up with renewal. A lot of the local environmental groups were concerned. It's a Coke Energy, SunCoke, and then they operate Indiana Harbor Coke Co. in East Chicago, which supplies ArcelorMittal there. And then the environmentalists had kind of been concerned that the permit was just going to be renewed without any without anything being paid to the repeated air quality violations they've had. They've repeatedly had, like, oven doors open and release far more emissions than were allowed. But apparently the EPA was taking it pretty seriously. They did announce that there had been multiple violations since 2010. They had, for instance, released like 160 excess tons of sulfur dioxide, 16 million excess tons of particulate matter, all these toxic gases that are, you know, have multiple deleterious health effects, like they're carcinogenic, they affect air quality, things of that nature. And they announced that they had reached an agreement, the EPA, the Department of Justice, the state of Indiana, and others had reached an agreement whereby SunCoke is going to pay a pretty steep $5 million fine, which is pretty high, for an environmental fine with these companies, and that they're going to invest in improving their operations and to significantly reduce or eliminate, you know, emissions of these hazardous air pollutants. They might have to shut down the worst performing coke battery there, where they've had a lot of the problems. They are going to also, because part of it is, like, there's been some lead issues in addition to particulate matter and everything, they are going to help clean up some of the lead hazards across East Chicago, not just the ones they're directly responsible for, but they're going to agree, to, you know, as part of this, they're going to help reduce lead hazards in schools and daycare centers, in buildings with, as they put it, priorities given to young women, young children and pregnant women. And then they're using this as a way to kind of address, you know, some of the ongoing issues that East Chicago has faced. But this has been a very serious concern about air quality for, you know, by a lot of the local environmental groups, because, this was a lot of avoidable pollution. Like, ideally, this would not have been happening. They have these operations all over the country where they produce steel, and they're usually able to stay within, you know, the accepted permit limits.
Now, have we gotten any local response to a word of the settlement and reaction to that?
Yes. Some of the environmental groups have been kind of mixed on it. They said, you know, that it's an aggressive compliance schedule they've been, you know, fighting for, but they still, which they've been fighting for, but they still want to kind of see more of what it entails. But generally, it's warmly received in that it's they're taking, you know, some action against, you know, to curb this air pollution. Some are concerned of whether it's really going far enough.
When we go from steelmaking and pollution problems to banking here in Northwest Indiana, and one of the stories that you've had that we're talking about today on Reporters Roundtable Thursday is dealing with a Munster-based bank, and they've done pretty well as far as we understand.
Yes, People's Bank, well, they did have, People's Bank, they were on pace to have a record year of profit last year. They were... They were on pace to make about $9.7 million, which would have been about a 3.7% increase. But they came into – they'll ultimately benefit from this tax cut that was passed by Congress, but pretty much all banks nationwide were forced to make huge write-downs in the fourth quarter, mainly for an accounting reason. These banks will consider, like, deferred taxes as an asset. So if they have any kind of tax write-downs in the future, like if they've already overpaid their taxes, or if they have losses that they can, you know, write down as or write down to save as taxes, or if they have income that they haven't had to report as taxes yet, it's generally considered like an asset that they're you know, they're not going to have to pay these tax things in the future, since their corporate tax rate is being reduced from 35% to 21%. They're no longer going to be able to save as much on taxes because their overall tax burden is going to be lower. So a lot of them have had to shrink that asset on their books. And in the case of People's Bank, they had to reduce it by or they had to do like kind of a one-time write-down of about $500,000. So it ended up making only $9 million for the year, which was down 2%. But it was like only a one-time write-down. And the 14% thing is going to mean higher earnings, net earnings that they're going to be able to pass on to their shareholders. So in the long run, it's just kind of a hiccup, but it doesn't affect them. It affects their results more dramatically because they're relatively smaller, but this has affected banks of all sizes throughout the country. Yeah. I believe it was some of the larger ones had paid, it's being characterized as short-term pain. Citigroup, for instance, is having to write down about $16 to $17 billion, and Capital One, $976 million, but it's just kind of a one-time accounting change in how they record their, you know, what they're going to be able to write down in the future on taxes.
Oh, so it seems like it's more of a temporary setback than anything else then.
Yes. Yeah. They're expecting, they had a really good year. They're expecting to have another, you know, continue to have good years in the future. Their profits are like way up even over a couple of years ago. They made $7.9 million in 2015. They're up to, even with this big write down, they're up to $9 million this year. That's showing significant growth. They're under new leadership. Their president CEO, Bed Bochnowski, had taken over from his father, and they've been continuing to grow the bank. And they're enjoying a pretty favorable interest environment with interest rates rising. They're seeing more of that income, and they're just continuing to grow.
Well, finally, Joey, one of the stories that you had in the newspaper here recently, online as well as in print, talked about Indiana's unemployment rate and how it's changed around. And we know, obviously, it's dropping again, and apparently that's going to be another area that Governor Holcomb can tout as an improvement. Tell us about that.
Yes. It does bounce around a little bit, but it's the jobless rate had been steady for several months, and it dropped to about 3.4% in December, down from 3.7%. That's the biggest drop in a while. Right now, we're ranked only we're the 14th lowest nationally, which is pretty pretty good, because we were much higher. We were usually in the second, like in the middle to the second half during the previous administration, and we're always kind of in the middle of the Midwest. I think we were 6 out of the 12 Midwestern states this past time. But it's the unemployment in the state is heavily tied to the manufacturing industry, which is notoriously cyclical. Like when times are good, it's so easy for them to add or subtract workers depending on how the economy is doing. We have a higher percentage of our workers here in Indiana work in manufacturing than in any other state in the union. So our unemployment swings around a lot more wildly than a lot of states that are more diversified. We have, when the economy is generally going good, you know, you'll drive by like the Lear plant in Hammond or somewhere, parking lot's going to be full. You know, that's not necessarily the case during a downturn when people aren't buying as many cars and SUVs and everything. But right now things are going pretty well. It was a pretty good year for unemployment. We were below the national average with unemployment, which was 4.1%. We've been kind of at or below the national rate of unemployment for like 2 years now, which again is pretty good. And it's we're generally what economists consider like, you know, full employment. There's always going to be a range where you're going to have, you know, like 3 to 4% of people are going to be unemployed for various reasons. You know, they're between jobs, or they're reentering the workforce, or, you know, there are various reasons that would contribute to where it's a literal impossibility that you'd ever have like 0% unemployment.
Right.
So right now we're kind of at the what economists would kind of consider the sweet spot for the economy.
Now, where does the unemployment rate for Indiana stand as far as our neighbors around us, Illinois and Michigan and the like?
We are out in the Midwest. We trail only North Dakota, Nebraska, Iowa, Wisconsin, and Minnesota. We have a lower rate than Michigan, Ohio, and Illinois. Mm-hmm. Illinois has the highest in the Midwest, and it's 45th nationally, I believe. They're, however, not doing that bad anymore, though. They're at 4.8%, which is not it's relatively high, but it's not terrible. The unemployment is actually higher here in some of our cities, unfortunately. We've got relatively high employment, particularly in Gary, East Chicago, and often I don't remember what Hobart's is offhand, but they're both above that 4.8%. They're both in the 6-7% range still, which is unfortunate. And you've seen even some companies, like from Elkhart and from some of the Illinois distribution centers, have actually had like job fairs in Gary and so forth, where they're offering to bus people like several hours to work at these positions, like at RV factories or at call centers, just because they're in such need of workers and they can't find any close to home.
Yeah, we've heard some interesting stories on NPR News about that as well in the past few months here too, where some states are really, really looking for workers, and they have the jobs, but not the people to be able to fill the jobs, to be sure. Joseph Peets, the business reporter for the Times of Northwest Indiana. And as always, Joseph, thanks for being with us to talk about these stories, and look forward to many more coming out soon.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me, Chris.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. On this Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in with Greg Tejeda, who's a reporter, mostly covers Gary News for the Post-Tribune. And as always, thanks for being with us today, Greg.
Very welcome.
Well, one big story I know that you've had in newspaper, online, as well as in print, is an update on the Civil Rights Museum that is proposed for the city of Gary. Bring us the latest, please.
The city wants to have a feasibility study to determine exactly how many people would visit Gary to see such a museum, and a business plan as to how it would run. And any firms that are interested in being paid by the city to do those studies for them had until Wednesday at 5 p.m. to submit their general plan, what they have in mind. Mm-hmm. And by mid-February, the city hopes to pick the firms that will actually do these studies, who will then spend their time from March the 5th through the end of August actually doing these studies to advise them. You know, they're trying to figure out, do they have the right location in mind for this? Because right now they're looking at a site near Grant Street and 8094. About a couple blocks there. They're trying to figure out, is that really the best spot for it? How should they run such a museum? Who would actually come to this? how profitable could it be? Basically, the city wants to make sure they're not getting into something that's completely over their head.
Yeah, it's understandable. Well, especially with something, even though this, it's been long working project here, I know in one pace, one way or another, they've gotten so close now to actually get this thing built and get it opened. I'm sure they want to be sure they don't make any mistakes.
Exactly, which is why they're planning on spending the spring and summer trying to figure out how to do this properly.
How are they figuring that they'll be able to get these studies paid for here, since this is a very new project?
The federal government has actually provided a $60,000 grant to Gary, which is specifically to pay for these studies. The city has to kick in a little bit of money on their own, and the Civil Rights Institute itself is kicking in some of the funds they've raised from private sources, but the bulk of this is paid for with federal funds. They have the money. It's already committed. It's like $60,000 they're getting from the federal government and like another $15,000 that the Institute and the city come up with on their own. The city council is going to be meeting again next week, and they're hoping to make some progress. They've been lingering lately on the issue of residency. There are some city officials who are absolutely determined to have it so that people who work for Gary city government actually live in Gary. And they're considering an ordinance that's been pending for about the past month. They're hoping they can get something passed next week when they meet Tuesday. It would create a process by which if city agencies tried to hire people outside of Gary for city jobs, they would actually have to come before the council and justify why a local resident could not do this duty, why they couldn't find a duty. And in theory, the city council could then be rejecting people who live outside the city.
Well, that's interesting.
This would not impact the police or fire departments. The public safety agencies, their hiring policies are actually set by the state law, and the state has already determined that police and fire only have to live within a county contiguous to where they work.
Right. Mm-hmm. So we're talking here about jobs, maybe like with the city clerk's office or similar positions like that, right?
Exactly. Some spots possibly with the city courts. Mm-hmm. However, there's also a possibility that the courts could appeal any challenges to their hiring. But, yeah, the city clerk, public works, they're trying to make sure that Gary residents can actually get these jobs. You actually have people who live here and have an interest in the community.
Have they noticed over time that's not been the case, that we have people that maybe they live in Hobart or maybe they live in East Chicago, they don't actually live in Gary, that they're working for the city?
That has been noticed in quite a few agencies and quite a few. You've got certain members of the council who will go on a nice long rant if you get them started. Mm-hmm. You know, they really believe this is the cause, and they ought to be trying to encourage Gary people to take an interest in this. And one way would be to hire Gary people for these kind of jobs.
Now, from what you understand, based on what this ordinance is all about, if the council does go along with this next week, when would this take effect?
This could take effect almost immediately.
Oh, really? They really are cracking down. They really and truly want to be sure that folks who work for the city of Gary live in the city of Gary, to be sure.
Like I said, this issue has been coming up off and on. They were trying all through last year, trying to impact the hiring of police and fire, but have run into so much opposition from state officials, and now they're focusing on other parts of city government, trying to get at least something in terms of a residency requirement.
Mm-hmm.
And as they'll be the first to note, you can't very well go into the city of Chicago and think you can work a city job there unless you actually live in the city.
No.
You know, they don't believe they're being unreasonable in seeking this.
I can see. One other story I wanted to ask you about, actually, it's more of a news release that's come out from Mayor Karen Freeman Wilson's office, and I guess that she's asked for help from the Indiana General Assembly on this, is to find a way to more easily handle demolition waste when they get the demolition contractors to come in and take down some of these abandoned homes in the city. They want to try to set up some kind of construction and demolition waste landfill, actually, within the city limits.
Right, you know, because they're concerned that they'd be just adding to the pollution of the city if they're just leaving the rubble all over the place. So they are trying to figure out what is the best way to dispose of it, make sure it doesn't become more of a hazard. Although there are some people who are more than willing to argue that Gary already has enough waste and shouldn't be trying to, they ought to be trying to find some other place away from the city.
Yeah.
This is just the ongoing argument. We're going to be hearing a lot about this issue.
I know this. Yeah, I'm thinking it's probably still going through the General Assembly right now, and the session's not ended.
That would be right.
Okay. Greg Tejeda is a reporter, covers news for the city of Gary for the Post Tribune. And as always, Greg, thank you for spending time with us today. We appreciate hearing from you about your stories, and we'll be checking back with you again real soon.
Thank you.
Students aren't the only ones who take tests for school. Educators have to pass exams so they can get their licenses to teach. But as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay reports, there can be a barrier there for potential teachers.
Most people have taken a tough test at some point in their life. But some teachers say licensing tests for their profession can be a barrier. Sean Harris says he's had trouble passing the math requirement for his elementary school teacher license, in part because it includes material he won't even teach his fourth grade students.
It goes all the way up to high school geometry, despite the fact that most of the skills on the test won't be taught in the elementary classroom.
And with a teacher shortage in the state, lawmakers want to fix that. A bill approved by the Senate Education Committee would let the Department of Ed waive some content testing requirements, specifically if a teacher fails a content exam twice. But new teachers would need to have maintained at least a B average in their coursework to receive a license. The bill also says schools can offer additional pay to STEM and special education teachers. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
And the bill to expand opioid treatment center options in Indiana got passed the Indiana House this week. And Jill Sheridan tells us that this proposal would add 9 treatment programs in the Hoosier State.
Indiana currently has 18 opioid treatment center options, and this bill would increase that number to 27. Bill author Representative Cindy Kirchhoffer says the centers would be approved to operate at local hospitals that apply.
So not only will you have the opioid treatment program, but you'll have the benefit of having a hospital treatment team to provide other supportive services.
Kirchhoffer says this will allow for more comprehensive wraparound services like medical treatment and counseling. The bill would also open some credentialing avenues for mental health providers to treat people in recovery. The legislation now goes to the Senate. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking, Reporter Roundtable Thursday. Our thanks to the panelists that who have joined us for the program today. From the Times of Northwest Indiana, State House reporter Dan Garden and business reporter Joseph Pete. And from the Post Tribune, reporters Carrie Napoleon and Greg Tejeda. And thank you for joining us on the program today. We'll be back with you on Monday.